UB Live at the National Science Complex of the State University of New York at Buffalo. I'm Dr. Michael Bozarth. The following presentation is a lecture delivered to my Psychology 451 course on drug addiction. The book is titled Fundamentals of Drug Addiction, A Psychobiological Approach. The book is currently in preparation with a spring 2013 anticipated publication date. Students enrolled in the course have access to printed text, study guides, and slides to support the learning objectives. These materials are not yet available to the general public. Sit back, enjoy, and learn. In addition to the acute effects of a drug, the short-term effects that we talk about, administer the drug, measure response, many drugs change their responsiveness with repeated administration. The effects can become stronger, the effects can become weaker. But all of these are a result of some sort of neurophysiological adaptation. At least the ones we're interested in are neurophysiological. There are some that would probably not involve neurons per se, but the ones we're interested in for drug addiction are going to be neurophysiological changes that can change the response to a drug. So the chronic administration can take on a much different profile than the acute administration of a drug. If we look at drug effects, some drug effects get weaker with progressive administration of the drug. Administer the drug day in and day out, you seem to lose effectiveness of that drug. That effect is related to what we call tolerance, which is something I expect everybody knows before they've ever come into a 400-level course at the university. Tolerance can be studied two different ways. You can look at what we call the constant dose method, which is the easiest way to see it, or you can look at the constant effect method, which is the way which is most applicable to both clinical and substance abuse conditions. The constant dose method is as simple as giving the drug repeatedly. In this particular example, presume that we give the drug every day. For this experiment, let's give morphine sulfate 40 milligrams per kilogram body weight to the animal, and you measure its ability to sedate the animal or to depress behavioral responding on the first day. On day one, you may see 80% of responding or 80% of maximum responding. On day two, you may see 70%, day three, 60, day four, 50, day 5, 40, and so forth, until after the administration of 8 injections, you finally end up with only 10% of the initial 80% suppression in activity or responding of the subjects that you're studying. That is a tolerance effect. You're losing the effectiveness of the drug. The subject's becoming tolerant to the drug. Another way of looking at the same thing is to look at the dose of drug required to produce a given level of effect. So that's what we call the constant effect method. If you look at the 40 milligram dose of drug on day one, which acutely causes the responding to be at an 80% of maximum depression you'd see in behavior, and you go over to this figure, the acute effect here shown as the pretreatment effect, you would find that this 80% would correspond to some morphine dose down here, such as the 40 milligram per kilogram dose I just referred to. If you were to take the animals after 6 more days of treatment and test them for the ability of morphine to suppress responding and generate now an entire dose response curve, what you would find is you can still depress activity by 80%, just as you could in the acute condition on day one, but the dose of drug now is much higher than what's required to suppress responding after 8 days of treatment than what it was on the first day of treatment. So it might require, for example, 100 milligrams per kilogram body weight morphine to suppress behavior to the same level that initially only 40 milligrams was required. You could, in fact, repeat the entire dose response curve and find out the various doses of morphine which produce various levels of response suppression. You could compare that to the initial acute effect, give 6 days of repeated injections, and then come back and do the dose response curve again and find out what the new doses are. How much does it take now to cause a suppression of behavior by 20%? You'd see a value that shifts over to the right like this. How much to suppress behavior by 40%, 50%, 80%? You would see pretty much a parallel shift in the curve under ideal conditions, just exactly what I've been thinking here. Why do we care about constant effect? Well, if you're taking the drug clinically for relieving pain, so it works this week to take care of your arthritic pain or your fibromyalgia, but at the end of the month, after 4 weeks worth of treatment, all of a sudden you're back to baseline hurting as much as ever. So what do? You have to increase the dose of morphine or oxycodone that's given to relieve the pain and given the analgesic effect. So from a clinical standpoint, what you're interested in is maintaining a constant effect. The only condition where constant effects aren't important is, for example, a post-operative condition or a maybe traumatic condition where you're in an automobile accident or you have surgery and you're given the analgesic to relieve the pain as you come out of surgery, but the pain and the nociceptive effect is diminishing over time as your tissue heals. So if I give you that 10 milligrams of morphine as an analgesic on day one in the hospital, it works fine. On day two, it's working. On day three, it's working. The only reason you're not seeing tolerance is because the pain stimulus is diminishing as you recover. So in that situation, clinically, you might get by with a fixed dose of morphine. But it's only because the pain's going away. With chronic arthritic pain, neuropathic pain, like in fibromyalgia or multiple sclerosis, the pain does not go away. It usually even gets worse. But if it were to stay the same, opiate administration shows tolerance, so you have to increase the opiate over time. So what the patient's demanding is if you relieve 80% of their pain when they first start the treatment regimen with oxycodone, at the end of 8 months, they still want 80% relief of pain. It's not enough to say, well, it does a little something, but yeah, I'm still basically back where I started. I'm experiencing a lot of pain. So you have to increase the dose. You have to maintain a constant effect. So this constant effect method becomes very important for clinical applications. For a drug addict who's trying to maintain that high, that buzz, if you want to put it into terms of affect-driven models, they're trying to maintain some consistent psychological state. And if that were to show tolerance, now they have to increase their drug to maintain that state. The constant effect method, again, is more applicable than is the constant dose method. So why would we ever study the constant dose method? For a very similar reason that we study rats running around in a box. It's easier to do. Now, sometimes easier to do isn't enough, because easier to do can end up studying something that is totally irrelevant to the question at hand. You're wasting your time. But when it comes to testing rats here, we know that the constant dose method and the constant effect method give us very similar results. We end up with similar conclusions from both those types of experiments. The constant effect method gives us a lot more data and a lot more information, but the constant dose method will give us a similar answer as far as the development of tolerance. Constant dose method, if I were to do the constant dose method in laboratory rats, I might take a group of 10 laboratory rats, administer them 40 milligrams per kilogram morphine every day, and then study them for 8 days and look at their locomotor activity. I could generate the figure that you see on the left with the constant dose method. If I wish to do that with the constant effect method, I would have to have 10 rats for each dose of morphine that I test. Each data point that you would see comprising this pretest dose response curve would require 10 rats. So that would be 80 rats right there. And then you give them their 6 days of chronic morphine treatment and then retest them on the 8th day. You might be able to generate that curve. But the degree of tolerance you get with 40 milligrams of morphine and how fast that develops may not be the same as the degree of tolerance that you get with 10 milligrams of morphine, which might be different than 60 milligrams of morphine. So if you really want to do this experiment properly, what you're really doing is 8 groups of rats under each 8 dosing regimens chronically times 10 animals per cell, or a minimum of 640 rats plus a few additional ones for subject attrition. That's a lot of rats. So we come back to the constant dose method. Whenever you can get the data that you're interested in from constant dose, it's a much simpler, much easier way to study the phenomena under question. Looking at tolerance is interesting enough, but why it's really related to drug addiction is tolerance, dependence, and withdrawal all seem to be intimately related. They all seem to kind of go together. When you see tolerance to a physiological effect of the drug, it's often accompanied by the development of dependence. And dependence is only demonstrated by the presence of withdrawal signs. It's the only way you know that you're dependent is to withhold the drug or to abruptly cease the drug action somehow, which can be either by withholding the drug physically, don't give the injection on a day that you normally were giving the injection, or in the case of opiates, you can use a pharmacological antagonist, administer naloxone, which will immediately block the effect of the opiate, like morphine, and will reveal any withdrawal that you have, and from the withdrawal you infer dependence. Now, tolerance you can study directly, but the only way you can really demonstrate physical dependence or psychological dependence is by abruptly terminating the drug action and then studying for withdrawal. Think about that. Otherwise, how else would you show that they depend on that drug action for normal physiological functioning, whether it's a somatic response like gastrointestinal tract motility or a psychological response like, I feel awake today, I feel alert. You have to withdraw the drug. That's the way it's demonstrated. Now, what does this all relate to? We think it's a type of physiological homeostasis. homeostasis. It goes back to Cannon and others back in the 1930s and even earlier, showing that many systems like blood pressure, when they're perturbed, when they're disturbed by some outside force, what happens is there are mechanisms that try to compensate for that and bring the value back within range. Think of body temperature, for example. Your body temperature tends to stay about 37 degrees Celsius, 98.6 on Fahrenheit. And your body, when it goes out of that range, you regulate. You do behavioral regulation first. You take off your clothes, right, to dissipate a little heat, or you put on clothes in order to retain body heat when it's getting cold. And you do physiological regulation, that when you're done taking off a few layers, you continue to perspire, trying to give off the excess heat, or you shiver in the case of being cold. When you shiver, you're actually causing very rapid muscle contractions. You probably know what shivering is. You can do the experiment in a couple of months out on the bus stop if you like. What that's doing is that's causing a lot of very, very fast metabolic activity, and metabolic activity generates heat. Just like you're working out at the gym, you generate heat. Whenever you're shivering, you generate heat. These are all interrelated, we think. The tolerance, when you see tolerance, that's often caused by a type of physiological homeostasis. In other words, the body's pushing back, trying to get some parameter, body temperature, blood pressure, maybe even affect, back into some normal range. And that results in tolerance. But then when the stimulus from the outside, whether it's a cold winter breeze or it's the pharmacological action of the drug, when that's abruptly removed, the body often overcompensates in the opposite direction. And that's the key now to understanding withdrawal reactions. When you want to predict withdrawal reactions, what you need to know is what the pharmacological action is of the drug. And then most of the time, you can predict what the withdrawal reactions to that drug would be. When we talk about physiological dependence, and the word here is very important, physiological dependence, we're talking about things which rely on physiology, the root of that word. You can divide physiological dependence into two general types. The first one I call physical dependence, which is characterized by somatic disturbances in various body functions, largely involving the peripheral or enteric nervous systems. Things like your stomach being upset, things like cold chills or sweating, things like tremor in your hand, or even a full-blown clonic-tonic seizure. These are all things that happen to your body. They're things that phenomenologically are interesting because you usually describe that as my stomach's upset, my bowels are loose in the case of an opiate addict, but they're things that are phenomenologically, I think, seen as external to the self. I don't want to go too far here. I'm on the thin ice of Cartesian dualism, which I'm moving to next. But it's one way to think about how these responses and these reactions are experienced. The other type of dependence that we have is psychological dependence. It's characterized by disturbances in psychological processes, largely involving central nervous system effects, which mediate affect, cognition, and I would add classically conditioned behaviors. For the most part, think of affect and cognition. That's the easiest to illustrate what we mean by psychological dependence, and we perhaps will move on later in the semester and talk about some of the more interesting things as far as classically conditioned responses and how this relates to dependence and withdrawal. They are usually characterized by first-person pronouns such as I feel sick, I feel depressed, I feel disinterested in things about me today, I feel anxious, I feel nervous, the things that phenomenologically are indistinguishable from the thing that we might label as the mind, should we have those kinds of conversations in the professor's course, which of course we are not, because I'm treading the waters again of Cartesian dualism. I want to avoid that topic totally. But if you need some way to relate to it, and I do, I'm always looking for analogies and parallels and ways that I can personally relate to it. What we mean by physical dependence is your body doing things. I don't know why my arm's twitching. It just started twitching. I feel really depressed today. I feel really down today. Those are two different sets of experiences phenomenologically, and I think they correspond quite well with what we would describe as physical dependence and psychological dependence. The important point to watch here, and it's a very important point that unfortunately is not appreciated by many researchers and people writing review papers and even book chapters on this subject. Psychological dependence has a physiological basis. I'm sorry, it's in your brain. It's in your brain. It has a neurochemical basis. The reason you feel blah today and disinterested in things has to do with neural activity in your brain. It's not pixie dust driving it. So both psychological dependence and what we describe as physical dependence both have a physiological basis. And I will point out again that most authors, even if they talk about physical dependence and psychological dependence, they will use the words physical dependence and physiological dependence interchangeably. I've done that myself, at least in one paper, probably more. In fact, I have it in a title, which is kind of hard to white out and go back and change. And I talked about physiological substrates of opiate withdrawal in the rat. And I used the word physiological. I don't know. I think at the time it was a 25-cent word when the nickel word didn't make it sound as scientific. And it was very popular to use it like that. As I go on to teach this course more and more, and my mind starts to sharpen the differences, I see why you need to keep these things different. Because if you call the physical withdrawal and dependence physiological dependence, what do you call the psychological thing? Oh, that's psychological. But that's to deny that it has a physiological underpinning, which is really important to understand, because in the end, it's the neurochemicals that you bring in exogenously in form of the drug, which upset the neurochemicals which are in the brain. And if you were to try to develop treatments for that, one of the approaches that you would use is trying to restore normal physiological function in the brain. So we don't really want to distinguish between psychological and physiological along some partition that confuses the fact that psychological dependence has a physiological basis. So my preference is strongly for using the term physical dependence. And I've been doing that for the last 15 or 20 years, mind you, but unfortunately I've been publishing papers even longer than that. And the more that we talk about these things, the more we think about it, the more we go back and say, you know, I should have go back and change those titles if I could. Now, types of tolerance. You have different types of tolerance. Often, again, authors don't pay very close attention to that. But I want you to understand that you could divide tolerance into some general types. The types of tolerance that we have would be pharmacokinetic tolerance, which involves increased elimination of the drug. For example, enzyme induction. If you take a drug which happens to involve enzymes in the liver and its elimination and metabolism, there are cases where the number of liver enzymes may actually go up. We call that enzyme induction. The drug may stimulate the production of enzymes that are responsible for the elimination of the drug. It's the same sort of thing that you might see in an immune response. Not the mechanism, but the same process, the same ball. You put in a foreign agent, the body might respond by producing more enzymes to eliminate that foreign agent. That happens to some degree with the barbiturates, but for the most part, you don't see a lot of pharmacokinetic tolerance. Usually, you're dealing with what's called pharmacodynamic tolerance, but unfortunately, many authors, again, confuse pharmacodynamic tolerance back with physiological tolerance. They're really two different mechanisms, even though the general process is the same. Pharmacodynamic tolerance would be tolerance to pharmacodynamic processes, which would be specifically what pharmacodynamics means. It's the binding of the ligand to the receptor and the transduction of that binding process. What happens after the ligand binds? Does it activate the cell? Does it inhibit the cell? Does it open sodium channels or chloride channels? Does it start up a second messenger system in terms of metabotropic receptors? What exactly happens? In addition to that, you also have physiological tolerance. And the mechanism of that's going to be quite different. In physiological tolerance, you wouldn't be looking for differences to the way things bind to the receptor or to what they do immediately after they bind at the receptor, but rather you'd be looking at things that involve feedback loops in terms of individual neural systems feeding back into the system which is directly manipulated. For example, if you had a drug which depressed neural activity, and as you give that drug repeatedly, it shows tolerance, that could be pharmacokinetic. More enzymes are developed in the liver or in the blood which metabolize the drug faster, so the drug gets eaten up quicker than it could get to the receptor. So you'd have to take larger doses of drug to produce the effect. That could be pharmacodynamic. There could be a shift in the drug's ability to bind to that receptor. Maybe the binding affinity goes down. It doesn't stick as well. Or maybe it involves some second messenger system like G-proteins, and the G-proteins aren't activated as much as they were initially. That would be pharmacodynamic tolerance. These two terms simply go back to what these terms mean, and they are introduced clearly in the chapter. Now, the physiological tolerance is somewhat different. There's no changes in the disposition of the drug. No changes in the enzymes or the elimination of the drug in any way. There's no changes in the receptor binding or changes even in the G proteins that are being activated or inhibited by that drug. What the changes involve are the neural system, which is depressed by my hypothetical drug, has a little feedback loop that comes back to maybe affect something else in that neuron, and that feedback loop now helps to maintain physiological homeostasis. In other words, when the activity is being depressed chronically, that feedback loop may have an excitatory action back on the neuron that's being depressed and may try to bring its activity back up to normal range. That would involve usually explicit neuronal elements, different neurons. You should have studied in biopsych some feedback loops. You know about glutamate and glycine and GABAergic feedback loops on the dopamine systems? That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. But unfortunately, it's usually not as easy as dispositional or pharmacokinetic tolerance. That usually doesn't happen. And receptor binding, in the case of opiates, does not explain tolerance. So you're stuck with G proteins, which seem to show tolerant effect, and also in terms of neurophysiology, which is an even easier way sometimes to see how these feedback loops work. Now, the last one is behavioral tolerance. I'll do that very quickly. Behavioral tolerance is where you compensate behaviorally for the effect of a drug. The classic example involves intoxication. If somebody's been drinking a lot at a bar, so they're starting to have trouble in balance in themselves and walking, for example, to the ladies' room because you've had one too many glasses of wine. But you've been drinking all afternoon with your lady friends, and now you're getting a little tipsy. So now you have to go to the ladies' room. So what do? You get up, and if it's not a very crowded bar, what you do is you put your hand along the bar and you kind of walk to the ladies' room. It gives you a balance point. Do you ever see that? You start to fall and you put your hand on a chair. You're not pushing yourself back from the chair unless you're really intoxicated. What you're doing is you're getting a reference point. Don't use this one in driving. But if the taxi cab dropped you off at the house and you can't hit the key in the lock, the trick is, same thing I use when I do brain microinjections and I can't see that tiny little hole in a rat whose head is moving to insert a 33-gauge diameter, which is, you know, a fat hair, basically, into a hole that's not much bigger, as I use my fingers and I rest it on the side of the head as a reference point. So I can thread a needle that way. In other words, I don't see the hole, but I do it by proprioceptive feedback. And you use the same sort of trick with the lock. In other words, you put your hand up against the lock, and you can kind of not feel the hole necessarily, but you feel the orientation. People have been known to do that driving automobiles, too. Don't. Because when you're intoxicated enough that you have difficulty putting the key in the ignition switch of an automobile, you have no business in propelling that vehicle down the road. But if you're one step away from getting safely in your apartment after having one too many drinks out with your friends, you can use the other trick to get in. Now, older people do the same thing. When you see them with a cane, they're not usually providing an actual point of support like you do if you break a leg and you put a crutch to help you walk. What they're doing is they're getting a balance point. They're not putting that much pressure on the cane. It's a third point reference where they're at. One last thing for your grandparents, or if you were to come see me in the nursing home, should I live that long? When older people are being escorted out to the mezzanine so we can get out of our room and see the sunshine on a beautiful Buffalo day, don't grab them by the arm and drag them along the way. Same thing for your friends that have MS or another neurological disorder. What they want to do is grab your arm. Now, sometimes they're grabbing it in case they fall, but what they're usually doing is the same thing you're doing with a cane, which is the same thing you're doing with the balance point, and the same trick I use when I come down the stairs in my proprioception, because neurological problems is not working that well. I can't really see the steps. I'm likely to fall. I use a balance point of reference. And proprioception goes to hell. Your feeling of body and space things. Okay, that's behavioral tolerance. It comes out most obviously in cases of intoxication. I put it in there simply to round out the types of tolerance. I put that in as a point of interest because more of you could probably relate to that type of tolerance after watching your friends out on a long Saturday night recreational spree, or older people in the old folks' home. That's not really behavioral tolerance, but it's a related thing, point of orientation. And most people confuse pharmacodynamic back with physiological tolerance, and a few people really just call the whole thing physiological. I find it useful to distinguish these four different types of tolerance because when you're looking at the mechanism, it has everything to do with what specifically you're looking for. For the most part, tolerance is tolerance. It's usually not pharmacokinetic tolerance. It's usually not as easy as to see that the drug levels actually go up and down. It's usually more complicated than that, in that there's some change in how the drug binds to the receptor, how it activates receptor mechanisms, or quite often, I think, it's this physiological tolerance I'm describing where feedback loops get perturbed. They get changed or put out of balance, so to speak. And behavioral tolerance is probably of lesser importance for all those types of things. Now, back on our main theme, dependence can only be shown by withdrawal reactions. I can't think of another way you could actually show the organism's dependent. You give the substance repeatedly, and then you measure behavior in the absence of the substance. Some people, and one of the people in particular that I have a lot of respect for, that I imprinted on when I was your age, Jerome Jaffe, He defines dependence as the state where you need the drug for optimal functioning. I find that totally misleading. I don't think he means what he says literally. Optimal functioning for me would be an extra 5 milligrams of amphetamine right now, or maybe 325 milligrams of caffeine. I'd be a little sharper. I'd be thinking a little better. My articulation may be clearer. That would be optimal. Instead, I'm just normal, which is not as good as optimal. So I wouldn't define it as optimal functioning. I use the word normal functioning, however you define normal. Now, how you define normal can change over time, and that's a different topic that I try to address in Chapter 12, second semester. But for the most part, it's your normal physiological functioning, your normal degree of alertness. If you used to have a certain level of alertness prior to learning to drink coffee, and then you've been drinking coffee for years to kind of maintain that state, and now you abruptly quit taking the coffee, you experience some somatic withdrawal, which we'd call physical dependence. Probably get a headache from it. Many people do. You might feel anxiety, which is on the verge of being a physical dependence, but also a psychological type of dependence. But the most prominent thing that many of us experience, even if we don't feel the headache or jittery, when we go off the caffeine, what we're going to experience is we're just not sharp. We just don't feel right. We just aren't as focused as what we feel we should be, what we define as the normal state. That's psychological dependence. Dependence, from my standpoint and that of most authors, can only be shown with the withdrawal reactions. If you come up with another way, let me know, and I'll be glad to think about it and change my slide. You can divide dependence into acute withdrawal syndrome and protracted withdrawal syndrome. I'm not going to do anything with that, so really you can pretty much consider these one and the same thing. All I would point out is that the acute withdrawal syndrome is short-term. It's the withdrawal reactions that happen within hours, sometimes a few days after the abrupt discontinuation of drug action. And it's sometimes the case that if you look closely enough, you can see long-term withdrawal reactions, which are reactions that take place over the course of days, even months after the drug treatment's been terminated. And that's considered protracted withdrawal. For the most part, addiction deals with acute withdrawal, and when you say withdrawal, it's implied that you mean acute withdrawal. We're not going to do a lot with protracted, although some people have theories of addiction based on protracted withdrawal. Why you would need to know that later when we talk about theories is that it will become pretty apparent quickly that the withdrawal reactions can't explain relapse to drug use. The withdrawal reactions usually take place a few days after the person has stopped using the drug. And even if they manage to get through 2 days, 2 weeks, or 3 months like Tracy did, they tend to relapse anyway. So some people have reached into their hat of magic tricks and they say, it's protracted abstinence. See, they still had some perturbation in their brain that existed 3 months later. That may be true, but you're starting to dig pretty deep in the magic hat there to bring those things out. Acknowledge that it's there, but the degree of withdrawal and dependence that you see with this protracted abstinence tends to be a very, very small fraction of the magnitude of dependence and withdrawal you see when you're looking at acute withdrawal syndrome. The relationship of tolerance to dependence and withdrawal reactions is quite straightforward. Many physiological systems respond to repeated drug action by neuroadaptive effects related to what I consider a type of physiological homeostasis. That can be partial or full tolerance. Sometimes the analgesic isn't as effective as it used to be, but it still retains some effectiveness. We would say that's partially tolerant to the analgesic effect. Sometimes it's full tolerance. By the way, I should mention when it comes to tolerance, you develop tolerance to different effects of a drug, usually at different rates. Opiates produce many different effects, as you should know from studying over the drug classification system and the drug effects. They produce analgesia, cough suppression, anti-dysentery or even constipating effects. They produce respiratory depression. They produce changes in pupillary diameter. They produce changes in body temperature. The tolerance effects often follow different time courses and sometimes are dependent on different doses of the drug. So you may start to develop tolerance, for example, to the analgesic effect of your oxycodone or your morphine injections, but you're not very tolerant yet to the constipating effect. So one of the side effects then of opiate administration happens to be constipation. When people are chronically ill, getting higher doses of opiates, they start to develop tolerance to the analgesic effect, causing them to take more and more oxycodone or more and more morphine, but they're not tolerant yet, at least not fully tolerant to the constipating effect. So constipation is a very serious side effect that can even lead to fatalities in individuals. Respiratory depression is sometimes the same thing. The analgesic effect is tolerant, so you take more, but the morphine is still a very effective respiratory depressant. So you keep taking more to obtain the analgesia, and you end up overdosing and dying from asphyxiation. This figure depicts Himmelsbach withdrawal reactions as rebound hyperexcitability model. And it's a model I happen to be very fond of because I think it helps to explain the relationship between tolerance, dependence, and withdrawal very clearly, very easily. It's an old model from the 1940s. 1943 is this particular paper. You have a physiological system here. Let's say this represents neuroactivity on a certain system. Could be even a physiological parameter like body temperature, body pressure, heart rate. Could be affect. Could be any number of things. That's why there's not a specific label here. But assume for the sake of illustration that the drug action comes in and it depresses neural activity. So you get a state of hypoactivity. If you were to insert an electrode in the locus coeruleus, norepinephrine-containing cell body, and you measure basal rates of firing there, you get a certain baseline rate that those neurons fire off spontaneously. If you administer morphine or any of the other opiates, you would see a depression in neural firing. It would slow down the firing rate. If you do that repeatedly, what you would see is the ability to suppress neural firing in the locus coeruleus shows tolerance. In other words, if you give the same injection every day for several days, all of a sudden, the cell firing rates are going back towards normal. This is a physiological response or a neuroadaptive effect, which is the way I visualize it, pushing back the other direction. It's pushing back towards that behavioral homeostasis set point, if you want to think of it that way. You can continue to give the same dose of drug, and you're going to continue to get neuroadaptive effects, which are pushing back even more from the hypoactivity that you see under the initial acute effect of the drug back towards baseline or normal activity. So you're getting partial tolerance, and if you continue this at the same dose, you eventually get full tolerance. What you can do then is you can increase your drug dose. If you double your drug dose, it pushes the reaction back towards the hypoactivity state because now you have a larger number of drug molecules interacting with the opiate receptors that are producing a larger physiological response. You still have the neuroadaptive effect trying to push back to normal, trying to regulate that physiological homeostasis, but the drug action now overpowers it because you've increased the amount of drug that's administered. If you keep giving that same injection dose, you're going to find that the neuroadaptive effects keep pushing back towards normal. They try to regulate back up towards a normal rate of cell firing. So now you come in, you give a higher dose yet. You flip it back in the other direction, producing more hypoactivity again. Whether or not you get back to the initial rate of cell depression in the locus coeruleus, or you only get back partially the magnitude of the effect that you had, it's not really important. But you keep adding more drug, the body keeps responding by a neuroadaptive effect, which keeps pushing it back more and more towards normal. If you keep taking that same higher dose of drug every day, you're developing more and more tolerance every time you take that drug. These physiological processes are working very hard to get back to normal. So what happens now if you abruptly quit taking the drug? Or, in the case of the opiates, you administer a narcotic antagonist like naloxone hydrochloride. You remove this drug action abruptly, but the physiological response is still there pushing back the other way. In other words, the physiological response that might be from a feedback loop has gone hyperactive on you. It's firing off faster than ever, trying to overcome the drug effect. So when you now remove the drug effect, you overreact in the other direction. The analogy I normally use is driving the automobile, and you're driving down the road at 70 miles an hour, and you encounter a hill. What do? Well, you depress the accelerator slightly more to keep the speed up. Now you hit the other side of the hill. What do? You have to back off the accelerator. What if you couldn't back off the accelerator? Down the hill. Especially if the hill is an abrupt drop and your foot doesn't go off the accelerator because it went to sleep or the cruise control doesn't work. You got a system that's opposing another system, and when you abruptly remove that opposition, then it overreacts. That is the rebound effect. You're rebounding from the drug effect. The system is hyperactive. That's pushing back, trying to instill normal physiological homeostasis. Pushing this way, somebody tries to push it back towards normal, and now you put more weight pushing the other direction again. That would be more drug. And now you're pushing even harder to move it back the other way. You're trying to balance off. The body's trying to keep some normal level, what it calls normal, within a set of parameters, like your heart rate, your blood pressure, and it has compensatory responses that happens at a physiological basis trying to maintain this type of homeostasis. If you abruptly remove the stimulus, which is depressing activity, then you're going to have a rebound hyperactivity that overshoots in the opposite direction. So if I had a system which was depressed by opiates, such as the locus coeruleus, And I keep increasing my opiate dose, trying to keep that depression there. It's showing tolerance. And then I quit giving the opiate. Then I'm going to see hyperactivity in the locus coeruleus. If that were body temperature, opiates produce hypothermia, a decrease in body temperature. So when I give the opiate, you start showing tolerance to that. So if for some reason I wanted to keep you hypothermic-inducing dose of morphine, keep increasing morphine. When I took you off that morphine, then instead of having hypothermia or even being back up to normal because you have tolerance from this neuroadaptive process that's instilling neurophysiological homeostasis, what would happen is you go into hyperthermia. You would overshoot the body temperature. And it would take a while for that neuroadaptive response, which is now used to having drug present, it would take a while for that to go back to normal. So you stay hyperthermic for maybe a matter of hours, maybe a matter of a couple of days. It usually goes back fairly fast. But there would be a period of time where you were cooking, you're a little over hot. Predictive withdrawal reactions is very simple. Use Himmelbach model. Whether that's actually what happens or not is not so important. And whether the drug produces an inhibitory effect or the drug produces an excitatory effect, the principle is the same. The neuroadaptive effect is an attempt at physiological homeostasis. It's going to oppose or go in the opposite direction. This is old stuff. This is what people knew a long time ago, but unfortunately too many people aren't studying the literature well enough, and we kind of forget to pass the torch on once in a while with knowledge. In other words, we forget about it. People have this recency effect. Things that happened recently, you tend to remember better, but also you tend to put higher significance to. So you often will have the feeling that newer data or better data theory just came out has to be really high. I have just the opposite perspective. When something's been out for a long time and it still serves as a really good explanation, maybe the best explanation for the phenomena under study, the more likely it is that's a valid explanation, or technically, the closer that explanation is likely to be to reality. We never really have the ultimate truth of these things philosophically. We get closer and closer to what we're trying to describe. So I like the test of time. I like things that are old. Things that are old has an enduring nature that suggests that they're more likely to be valid than somebody's latest bend off the top of their cup theory, which today it's solving opiate addiction, next week you never heard of it again. And I'm old enough now that I've gotten to see a lot of cycles of that. I don't get too excited when you bring me in an article that just solved opiate addiction. You know, I wait a little while before I get excited. Now, coming back to it, it's a very simple model. Predicting withdrawal signs, very simple with this model. Just look for the opposite of what the drug does. What we have here are various somatic effects that are produced by opiates. Opiates are generally depressant drugs. I would assume everybody knew that before they come into the class. They're often classified pharmacologically simply as depressants, as you'd classify barbiturates, as people classify alcohol even. So many people put those in the same grouping because they're all depressants. And then the stimulants, like psychomotor stimulants, cocaine and amphetamine, they put in the same grouping with caffeine because, after all, they're all stimulants. It's nice when you can have life that simple, but usually it's a little more complex. But do at least know what you should have already known. They're generally depressant drugs. So most of what they do refers to depressing neurophysiological action. There are going to be some very important differences here, but we won't get into those until the very last module when we talk about biological mechanisms. But let's look at what opiates do. They decrease heart rate. They decrease respiration. Now, decreasing respiration is really important to know because opiates kill by decreasing respiration so much that you're not breathing and you basically hold your breath to death. You die of asphyxiation from opiate overdose. Usually the heart's still pumping away, but you quit breathing. So you go into cyanosis and you die. They also decrease GI tract motility. Now, there's really two components that I mean by that. You have peristaltic motion of your stomach and intestines, the GI tract, and it basically takes the food from the stomach and it kind of massages it with a rhythmic contraction of the smooth muscle through your GI tract. Now, there's a second feature to that. You have something called the anal sphincter. That's a muscle that's at the anus that stays fairly well under your control. When you learn to control your bowels, you become toilet trained, as we say. By the way, I should point out one more thing. You get withdrawal from other things besides the opiates and the barbiturates, but they don't call it withdrawal. They call it discontinuation syndrome. If you read the clinical literature on the SSRIs, they don't talk about SSRI withdrawal. SSRI discontinuation syndrome. That's a near miss. You know, in the airline industry, near miss is when the two planes almost collide. don't confuse that with not being the same thing. That's a smoke and mirrors trick, trying to distance what happens with some therapeutically administered drugs like steroids and the SSRIs. They produce clinically significant dependence and withdrawal, but we don't call it that. We call it discontinuation syndrome. Some people call opiate withdrawal discontinuation syndrome too. Again, they like those 25-cent words when most people use a nickel word that connotes the same thing. We mean the same thing by both those terms. Now, coming back to opiates. They decrease heart rate. Okay, that's fine. More importantly, they decrease respiration. That's how you die. They decrease GI tract motility, which means they decrease the peristaltic motion in the stomach, but they also contract the anal sphincter. They tighten that up, and that's what keeps the bowels locked in, keeps them locked in long enough so that an adult can control their bowel movement, and also, and this is important physiologically, that it absorbs the nutrients and the moisture back out of the waste material before it's excreted from the body. These two things are important because that's also what produces constipation. Tighten up the anal sphincter, slow down peristalsis, and now your bowels aren't moving. You're getting stopped up. And that can be one of the really nasty side effects from clinical use of opiates in the management of pain. They also cause a decrease in pupillary diameter. One of the signs that you see when people are on opiates is you'll see pinpoint pupils. In particular, when you have low, dimly illuminated rooms, such as this one, what happens is your pupils normally should dilate a little bit to accommodate light. And when you're under opiates, your pupils tend to get constricted even when they should be dilated. So it's one of the things that you look at for opiate effects. Somebody's overdosing, their pupils would be constricted usually from an opiate, but not necessarily constricted from other drug treatments. Now, what are the psychological effects? Well, when you're on the opiate, you're high. That's something you might have been confused about with some other classes because people are into not letting you know that they make you high, that people take these drugs because they increase mood and affect and make you euphoric, not because they make you feel like hell and sick and crappy. They make you feel good. The other thing they do is they decrease your behavioral arousal. That's where the narcosis comes in. Narcosis is that state where you're kind of detached from your surrounding, immobile. And a rat, they get so immobile, they get rigid like little boards. And again, I'll talk about that when we get into the mechanism with the last module a little bit, describe what these effects actually look like. Now, what are the withdrawal reactions you're going to predict from all that? Withdrawal reactions are real easy. First of all, the heart rate's not that prominent, but you will get tachycardia, where the heart's beating fast, and sometimes they describe their heart pounding out of their chest. But for the most part, that's not a very important sign. Where the withdrawal signs really come in are things like respiration. They'll be in very rapid respiration, sometimes to the point of hyperventilation, usually not, but breathing quickly. The most obvious signs, though, come down here with the GI tract. You will find that the peristaltic motion of the stomach now is going really fast. It's really trying to push that food and waste material out. And the anal sphincter, which is normally contracted and even under your voluntary control, all of a sudden that sucker is dilated. So you're getting this stuff being propelled through your stomach really quickly with a wide open anal sphincter. You are pooping all over the place. That's one of the withdrawal signs we see not only with humans but with rats as well. So that's one of the big withdrawal signs. It's the opposite of what they do pharmacologically. They normally constipate. Withdrawal would be diarrhea. Another thing that you're going to see, of course, is the behavioral arousal level. Normally, the opiates depress behavior, so what's the withdrawal sign going to be? Agitated. You saw Jake in withdrawal in a couple of different scenes. You saw him with Jim, I think it was, when he was breaking up with Jim. Jake was not just having a good time. He was running around kind of slamming the doors and agitated. You saw him on the street and also vocalizing some obscene remarks to people that were watching him in his withdrawn, agitated state. The body sometimes seems to move so much that the individual, if they see, I don't know, a can or a garbage can, they'll kick it across the room. And that's probably where the euphemism kicking the habit comes from, which is an expression for going off of opiates, now also applied to other drugs that originally came from opiates. The thing that's more interesting to psychologists even than the arousal level is the mood. If the opiates bring you up in mood when you're on them, what happens when you go off them is you feel depressed. You can feel so severely depressed that you're clinically depressed, but usually it's more just a flattened affect, feeling like crap, not interested in things, kind of leave me alone, detachment from what's going on in the world around you. Not interested in anything except getting more opiate, but as far as let's have sex, you're finally off drugs, maybe you won't be impotent anymore, honey. You don't want to have sex. You don't want to have sex when you're on the drug, and you certainly don't want to have sex now that you're off the drug. Okay, so depressed mood, that's what I'm pointing out. Let's talk about quickly cross-tolerance. That's exactly what it says. If you're tolerant to morphine, you're tolerant to oxycodone, you're tolerant to fentanyl, shows cross-tolerance within class. Same thing for barbiturates. If you tolerant to phenobarbital, you're tolerant to cyclobarbital, you're tolerant to methohexital, another barbiturate. Sometimes you get cross-tolerance between classes. Where that's really important is between the benzodiazepines, which are the minor tranquilizer used as anxiolytics. The benzodiazepines show cross-tolerance with alcohol. So if somebody's an alcoholic, they'll be taking really large doses of alcohol, so they have strong physical dependence and withdrawal. If you give them benzodiazepines in detox, you can stabilize them and then gradually wean them off their benzodiazepine, as opposed to giving them 4 shots of whiskey per hour, tapered down to 3 shots to 2 over the course of the days and using alcohol. You can use benzodiazepines to medically stabilize them. If we look at psychomotor stimulant effect, psychomotor stimulants increase heart rate, increase respiration, really no effect on GI tract motility. They cause a dilation of pupils. When you look at withdrawal reactions, on the mood, of course, is elevated with psychomotor stimulants, the euphoric, and they increase arousal. When you see withdrawal from the psychomotor stimulants, then the effects are just the opposite. The somatic disturbances increase heart rate, increase respiration. The withdrawal reactions are opposite the pharmacological effect, just like they were with the opiates. You have a slight increase in heart rate, respiration, no change in the GI tract, and you have some constriction in the pupillary diameter. Those tend to be relatively minor signs. So they're grayed out in this illustration. And for the most part, we say they do not produce physical dependence in the classic ways that we define dependence, meaning opiate-like or alcohol-like or barbiturate-like physical dependence. That's important to know for a number of reasons, but one of which, as recently as the 80s, and I'm sure a few people, even into the new millennium, are still teaching that these drugs are not addictive because they don't produce physical dependence. So you have no motivation to take these drugs. Of course, they're forgetting the effects on the affect, psychological action. If they cause an increase in mood and euphoria, then when you go off that drug, it's going to cause depressed mood, anhedonia, flattened affect, and so forth. That's often what you see with somebody that's been on a binge cocaine or methamphetamine pattern. They take a lot of the drug and they stay really high. They do this for anywhere from hours to days. When they go off of it, they have a crash. They just like ran into the wall going really fast and they abruptly stop. They're like the plastic sunglasses on your dash on a hot summer day. They seem to just kind of melt into the couch or chair and they can't move. They're not interested in things, sleep a lot and so forth. So the arousal level is depressed, as would be predicted, and the affect is depressed. Severity of withdrawal, very important to know. Alcohol and barbiturates both produce very, very strong physical dependence. The withdrawal of these drugs abruptly, unmedicated detoxification, it's abrupt withdrawal, can lead to very severe withdrawal reactions that can be life-threatening. Both of these drugs have prominent effects on the GABAergic systems, and I suspect a lot of the withdrawal reactions that are most severe come from that. And that's just a hypothesis, but I think others would concur. GABA is that ubiquitous neurotransmitter that you have seemingly everywhere in the central nervous system, brain and spinal cord, and it holds neuroactivity in check. So if something were to work on GABA and show that hyperactivity, when you abruptly withdraw the pharmacological agent, then you would see, in this case, a hypoactivity of the GABAergic system, which would now release things like convulsions, maybe full-blown clonic-tonic seizures and so forth, as well as cardiac arrhythmias and other cardiovascular events. So the alcohol and barbiturate withdrawal can be life-threatening. Opiate withdrawal is never really life-threatening. Somebody died in Toronto a couple years ago. They had a pre-existing cardiac condition. If you have a pre-existing condition, then there may be a rare case of somebody dying from opiate withdrawal. But the important thing to know is opiate withdrawal is never really life-threatening, not in itself. And that tells you something about the magnitude of the withdrawal. It's much, much less severe than is the withdrawal of the experience with alcohol and barbiturates. And the opiate withdrawal is much greater than any withdrawal you might get from cocaine. In fact, cocaine, again, and amphetamine are considered to be drugs that do not produce physical dependence and are not associated with withdrawal syndrome. Why that's particularly important is that fails to predict the addiction liability. If you look at addiction liability, you see the addiction liability of cocaine and heroin are basically the same, and they're roughly equivalent to the addiction liability of the barbiturates. The barbiturates may be slightly less addictive, they might even be slightly more, but the fact is they're roughly in the same ballpark as cocaine, heroin, the other opioids, the other psychomotor stimulants. Both of these, and if you include barbiturates as a third class, are much more addictive than is alcohol overall. The line of evidence that I'd use, just in common sense here, is to think about the exposure that people have to alcohol, especially college students in a certain period. A freshman year and sophomore year, you grow out of it, don't you? You know, you go out with your friends, maybe drink excessively on the weekends, your grades aren't doing so well. But people are exposed to a lot of alcohol. And many of those people, not all, most of those people, walk away from that and kind of grow up when they graduate. They get into jobs where they have a career and they have to worry about their career, their family.
other sorts of commitments in their life. Not everybody. Some people develop chronic alcohol problems. But imagine if you're taking cocaine and heroin for 4 years or 5 years of undergraduate studies. And imagine also if society actually encouraged you to do that. You know, your role models were, it used to be television advertising, Eric Clapton having a Michelob. Eric Clapton is cool, man. I want to be like Eric. I want to drink Michelob. You know, you have this peer pressure, all these positive effects trying to get you to take the substance. Imagine if that were in the psychomotor stimulants. Some drugs, instead of showing tolerance, they show what people might consider a type of reverse tolerance. And that's more technically called sensitization. Learn the word. Learn to pronounce it. Sensitization. That is a very important word to put into your vocabulary. I'll show you very quickly how that works. If we have a group of rats, we divide them into two groups. We give each group an injection of physiological saline, the vehicle that we use for mixing up a lot of our drugs, and then measure motor activity. We would get a nice number here in a pretest, like 780, 800 counts that they make in a 30-minute trial period. If we administer to one group of rats 10 milligrams of cocaine, what we'd see is that would cause an increase in their motor behavior. So we do a pretest. Then 3 days later, we hit them with 10 milligrams of cocaine hydrochloride. What we'd see is that stimulates locomotor activity. So that effect is basically the same thing I showed you earlier on the dose response curve, except here I'm just going to use one dose of cocaine. If we take those same rats and we administer that same dose of cocaine 3 days later, 10 milligrams per kilogram, we don't get an effect like we did acutely. We get an effect that looks like that. That's called sensitization. That 10 milligram dose that we gave them right here, we give them the same 10 milligram dose here. The magnitude of stimulation is actually over twice as much as what they showed on the first day. They're becoming more sensitive to the cocaine. This level of activity that's seen after only one experience with cocaine, this level of activity looks just like we gave them 20, 30 milligrams of cocaine. But we didn't. We gave them 10 milligrams of cocaine. Now, 3 days later, we pop them with 10 milligrams of cocaine again. Here's the effect that we get. Voila. It's going up over time. It's showing sensitization. Why sensitization is going to be so important is that sensitization is going to parallel the reinforcing effects of the drug. So if you were to look for a neuroadaptive effect, which would be intimately related to drug addiction, it wouldn't be tolerance. We'd become less sensitive to the drug's motivating effects. It would be sensitization, where you become more sensitive to the drug's motivating effects.
These podcasts are copyright 2012 by the Addiction Science Network. They are produced in collaboration with the State University of New York at Buffalo and are provided solely for educational purposes. Podcasts can be directly downloaded from www.addictionscience.net. Transcripts are also available for some podcasts at our website, as are other documents and commentaries regarding drug addiction and select topics on psychopharmacology. These podcasts can be copied and freely distributed as long as the source is acknowledged and provided they are not edited in a manner which changes the fundamental meaning of the selected passages when quoted out of context of the entire presentation. Correspondence from professional colleagues is welcomed and can be sent to info@addictionscience.net. We do not offer clinical services, nor do we usually have time to reply to questions emailed from the general public. When listening, please keep in mind that these podcasts are targeted for academic and professional listeners. Everyone is invited to share any information they find useful, but our target audience is not the general public. Finally, please note that the Addiction Science Network is the sole author of this work, and views and opinions expressed herein should not be construed as official policy of the State University of New York.